This is an ABC podcast.
Claire G. Coleman grew up in WA in a forestry plantation with her family. There wasn't much money, but there was so much freedom and friendship there. Claire was tall and she stood out, and for a very long time she put that down to her Fijian ancestry. Except she wasn't Fijian. It was only as an adult that Claire discovered the true story of her ancestry, which came as a shock to many members of her family. Claire G. Coleman is an author now, and she's written two highly acclaimed novels. But she'd already lived multiple lives before she even began to hit the keyboard. Claire has lived in the suburbs of Perth, she's been homeless on the streets of Melbourne, and she's lived in a caravan for years and years, which she and her partner took right around Australia through every nook and cranny, not once, but twice. And so when Claire G. Coleman was ready to write, all that life experience and imagination just came pouring out of her. Her most recent novel is called The Old Lie. Hello, Claire.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
Fine, thank you. This plantation I mentioned, can you paint a picture of it for me, please?
Sure. It was a plantation. It was enormous. It was now the northern suburbs of Perth. At the time, it was way out of town. It was blocks of pine trees growing for wood, and kind of in the middle of them was an open space and a settlement with about 14, 15 houses all along one road, one side of one road.
What kind of out, like tin and timber houses?
Yeah, tin and timber. Mm. Unlined walls for the most part. So it was just like oiled timber houses. Log cabins, really.
And how many families were living there?
I think there were 14 families or something living in the forestry settlement. And behind this settlement was a fire break and then kind of uncleared Bankshire Forest. They went for kilometres. You can almost imagine this being the sort of place where you don't know what's going on because there's this row of houses in the middle of nowhere.
Now, your dad was a forester. Did he come from a family of foresters?
It's basically, for a couple of generations, was the family trade. My dad's worked in foresters on and off for most of his life until he retired.
So you grew up in this really quite a closed community. It was surrounded by tall trees, mm-hmm. bush all around you, and this enormous expanse to play in. Was there a gang of kids you could play with?
Yeah, every family had kids. And it was basically one big gang of kids. It wasn't division of gang of kids. It was just like one big surging mass of kids everywhere at all times. Yeah, there'd be kids in people's garages or running off into the bush. There was always something going on, lots of riding of bikes and climbing of trees and falling out of trees and kids getting hurt and walking home. All those things you expect when there's a lot of kids and not much supervision.
Was everyone looking out for each other in this community?
They were, yeah. All the kids were friends. I don't think we had much choice but be friends because all our dads worked together and we all went to school together. He didn't know not to like each other. This, I guess, in a way. It was just a mass of kids.
I don't mean to get all A.A. Milne on you, but was the forest a kind of an enchanted place for you kids to play in?
Well, I loved the forest. The Bankshire woodlands behind the settlement was basically where I always went. The pine forest, a very different environment because the Bankshires were all scraggly and bendy and it was all distinct. You knew where everything was and you could find anything. You'd never get lost. Whereas the pine plantations, perfectly straight lines of pine trees, tall, narrow pine trees, really as far as the eye could see.
So there's no mystery there, is there?
And easy to get lost.
Yeah, easy to get lost.
Yeah, because if you go far enough and turn the wrong angle, everything just disappears behind the trunks of trees. And apparently the only time I got lost in my life, I was a really little kid at a family picnic in the pine trees and I wandered off and they found me behind a tree. The wrong side of a tree from the family, and of course I couldn't see anyone, and the forest looks the same in every direction.
Did you see weird stuff there?
I mean, there was a weird wildlife. It's WA, so the snakes were the constant fear.
Like big snakes?
Big snakes. There was the 12-foot tiger snake that started at one end of the row of houses.
Oh, God.
And all the houses were on little stilts, and it started at one end of the row of houses and went under every house one by one, and no one knew which house it was under because it slithered under a house, disappeared for a while, and then come out and slithered under a house again. And it was huge. And then there was the enormous dugong. Because my dad told me the story, and I don't remember it happening when I was a kid, but we had an outdoor toilet. You'd go out of the house, and you walk across the backyard to the outdoor toilet. Went to the outdoor toilet one day, and I wandered out there. Apparently I came back and said, "Dad, there's a snake in the toilet." And my dad thought he'd go out there and find a little snake in the toilet in the outhouse. He went out there, and apparently there's a snake that was wound around the toilet bowl four times. I was apparently quite calm about it.
Yeah, see, I live in a city, but I'm just never going to use a toilet ever again now. I don't think I can possibly do that from now on. That's just made me too paranoid.
I don't think that sort of thing happens very often. You don't really see big snakes in outhouses, but it does. I think it does happen from time to time.
Your dad being a forester, what kind of stuff did he come across going into the depths of the forests?
Well, because the forest is like the largest big forested area near Perth, there's a lot of nefarious activity that happened around the forest. Well, my dad has found people growing cannabis in the forest, or found their crops and reported to the police.
Well, do they think they'd not be discovered?
They think they'd not be they don't think that obviously they don't think that the forestry workers ever went into their forest. Right. I don't know. I really don't know. That sounds strange. And every now and then there'd be a big fire. My dad also fought fires. It was part of a requirement of his job that he'd be available to fight the fires. So they had firefighter training. My dad was always fighting fires, like at least once a week, sometimes for days and days at a time. And more than once, probably, and one I'm certain of, because he's told me the story more than once, he went to a fire and they traced the fire at the start of it, because normally in a bush, a fire will go one direction for some time, and you can always trace back to where it started. They went back to where it started, and there was an abandoned car there that had been set on fire. And it's always best to check if there's nothing make sure there's nothing explosive in the car. So they popped the boot, and there was a body in it. Somebody had murdered someone and then chucked their body in the boot, parked in the forest, and then set fire to the car and walked out of the forest. I don't think that's my dad's only horrible story like that, but that one he's told me more than once.
I'm just thinking of episodes of The Sopranos here, about how much dirty work was buried in the forests of New Jersey. So that's where people put their evidence of their misdeeds.
Almost certainly. Probably the body in that boot would have not been found for longer if they hadn't set fire to the car. If you think about it logically, they set fire to the car, then someone goes looking where the fire starts.
And there it is.
So if they just left it there, they probably would have gotten away further before.
And did your kids know about this at the time, or did your dad tell you when you got older?
I'm pretty sure Dad told me when I got older. Not much older, probably about 15 or something when I heard this story. But I don't think I heard it when I was really, really little.
So you said your dad was a firefighter. Did that mean he'd have to sort of leave at the drop of a hat at Christmas time and around that?
Oh, absolutely. It's probably one of the things that kind of gives me the most emotions when I'm thinking about my childhood, because when we were in the forestry settlement, if there's a fire, there was a big siren that went off at the forestry's office, and all the men would have to run out of their houses and either jump in cars and drive down to where the fire trucks were, or run down the road in their overalls to fight the fire. It wasn't unknown for my dad to get called out for fire, and then while he's in the fire truck, find out there's another fire and get called out to that one. So it wasn't unknown for him to go away for days and days and days, jumping from fire to fire, especially in summer.
Would you be frightened that he wouldn't return?
Every time. I was frightened every time my dad wouldn't return. And if I saw smoke when I was a kid, or smelled smoke, I'd be worried that this would be the time that my dad would go to a fire and not come back.
So when he does come back, does he look like a hero to you then?
Yeah, my dad's a hero. My dad's totally a hero. He's told me so many stories. We went through so much for my dad to be a hero as well. And I don't hold against him, of course. For example, if they were on fire standby, which half the fire crews would be on standby each weekend, which means standby means stay at home, no alcohol. So even if if it was Christmas, no wine at Christmas, because they have to be able to rush to a fire at the drop of a hat. And I'm traumatised a little bit, not terribly traumatised, because I understand that it was necessary, that by things like my dad going away to fight a fire on Christmas Eve and not coming back till around New Year's. Oh, yeah, I do think my dad's a hero.
What did he look like when he would come back from those big firefighting?
Well, the fires had these bright orange overalls, and his overalls would come back and they'd be brown, not orange anymore. And dad would be super tired, scratched up, covered in redback spider bites. Because redbacks live in the bushes, and if you run through the bush enough, redbacks fall in your clothing if you run through the wrong sort of bush in WA.
How do you get covered in redback bites and survive?
Of course they can. Depends who you are, but some people have a allergic reaction to redbacks. Some people just get a few redback bites and go, oh, look, it's a redback. But everyone in my family survived at least one redback bite. My mum survived one on the toilet seat. I'm serious.
was a redback on her toilet seat when she was there one night. Yeah.
It was at a party at the town hall at the forestry settlement, and my mum sat down and got bitten on the arse. And she will kill me for saying this, but I don't care.
It does happen, based on true stories. So tell me then, Claire, why was the town tip your favourite place?
The tip, if you imagine a town where everything, impossibly it was ever in that town, and everything in the forestry's office all ends up in the tip. Anything. Could be anything. Paperwork, abandoned cars, tractors. Literally everything would end up at the tip. So
it's more of a junkyard than a tip.
It was a junkyard, right. But it was also all the bags of rubbish from the houses.
Right.
Everything.
So it stank.
It stank. There were probably rats and other nasty animals. But you could also rummage through and find cool bits of rubbish and cool things. We used to do all sorts of crazy things, like climb around over old hulks of vehicles and find any bottle with some liquid still left in it and mix it all together and see what happened, no matter what it was. I remember doing that. I remember that being particularly fun, like India ink, murder oil, Prussian blue ink, yeah, the toxic stuff, tip that in a bucket with some other stuff.
So how did you encounter the first book that meant anything to you?
Well, I was playing at the tip. I don't remember how I found it at the tip, but I saw a book and I loved the cover. It was a tree and a strange creature, and it was Lord of the Rings. The single-volume edition, the 1974 single-volume edition, which is the same year as I was born, incidentally, in a single volume. I was about 8. I'd never read a novel. I'd only read books on how to read and encyclopedias and stuff like that and kids' books. But I got this book and I took it home and I read it cover to cover at 8 years old. And from then I read it over and over and over again till it fell apart.
What was it about it that you loved?
I loved the way it played with the concept of story. The Lord of the Rings was my favourite book for a long time, and I find it problematic now, but at the time I loved the way that it manipulated fairy tale and story and used language and played with the way people think using story, and it taught me not only is story incredible, but I think we as a society underestimate it. And I don't think Tolkien underestimated the power of story. I think he was perfectly aware of how important story was. And that's what I think struck me, even though I only really have words to express what I liked about it now.
So you were 10 when you left the forest with the family. Mm-hmm. What happened to that forest?
Well, they initially dug up bits of it for a silica mine. Apparently it had among the purest white silica sand on Earth.
It's probably just turned into the glass that's on mobile phones and computer screens
days. We knew that it was good quality silica because have you heard of petrified lightning?
No.
It's where lightning hits silica sand and you can see a vague lightning strike piece of really rough glass in the sand. There was petrified lightning found every now and then around the forestry settlement. And so it was silica mine for a while, and now it's a suburb with the same name. The forestry settlement was called Nangala, and there's a suburb called Nangala in the same spot.
So did your dad have to continue working as a firefighter?
My dad was still a firefighter and still had fire tower duty.
What's that?
WA is really prone to fire. So before they had spotter planes and satellite imagery and all that stuff, they'd put a poor guy up the top of a tall tower taller than the trees with a little shed on top of it, and he'd sit there for a 12-hour shift looking at the forest to look for fires.
So this tower that went like all the way atop the trees. And you'd sit above the trees and he'd sit up there
and
for what, 12 hours?
Look for smoke.
Yeah. Did you ever go up there with him? Was there a bit of a take your daughter to work day?
Oh, yeah, it was fun. I used to go with Dad every now and then, not all the time, because it's a bit boring sitting there for hours and hours and hours and hours. But I'd take a book or I'd play chess with my dad. You'd have tea from Dad's thermos and have a sandwich with Dad and sit up in the tower. And you'd look out and you'd learn to look for the smoke.
Did you ever see a fire up there?
Yeah, we saw some small ones. Then the radio, they'd call on the radio and the fire crew would go out and put it out. When they were spotting fires from the fire tower, they'd have a pair of Polaroids sitting there, Polaroids and glasses, and they'd see something coming up from the forest, like a wisp or something, and you put your glasses on. If it's mist, it'll disappear. If it's smoke, it's still visible.
So you get pulled out of this idyllic kind of forest creature existence that you were living there, like some kind of sylph of the forest that you were back then, and you moved to suburban Perth. What was high school like for you in suburban Perth?
It was a really rough school, really violent. I've heard that now it's still considered a rough school. It was considered one of the roughest schools in Australia, and now it's still considered rough. I don't think I want to name it, but it was a rough school.
Was there a bunch of misfits you could hang around with?
Oh, yeah, there was a bunch of misfits. I think there's always a bunch of misfits. At least initially, the misfits gang kept away from all the violence, and then suddenly one summer, a couple of members of the misfits gang I was with suddenly went from being small to huge over summer holidays, and then we didn't have to avoid anyone anymore. We just kind of the two big guys would punch anyone who tried to bother anyone. But I had my little gang. You always have your little gang, don't you?
All this time you'd been told you were Fijian.
Mm.
Who had told you that?
My dad told me that, and his dad told him that. Yeah, it was weird because I was Fijian, but then as an adult I realised I had no understanding what being Fijian meant, which is weird. My dad is dark skinned than me. My dad's quite dark, and his dad was really dark. But yeah, we're just told we're Fijian, and it was a good defence in school when being picked up for being black and saying no, we're Fijian.
But the truth was, you were Aboriginal.
Yeah, I was Aboriginal. It turns out there'd been clues of that for a long time. People have told Dad that he looks more Aboriginal than Fijian. Well, I should have known because I grew up believing I was Fijian but had no understanding of what it meant to be Fijian. The cracks started to show when I made a Fijian friend the first time I went to university, the degree I never completed, and I realised that I didn't know any of the cultural stuff he did. My dad didn't know any of the cultural stuff that Fijian people do.
Looking back, can you see any sign? Do you remember any moments when you thought, oh, that happened because actually I'm Aboriginal and not Fijian? Were clues presenting themselves to you as a kid?
Well, yeah, my dad was a really good tracker. I remember my dad showing us how to tell if a kangaroo was being chased or not, while being chased by a dog. Things like that. Just little things about tracking that my dad knew that a Fijian wouldn't know how to track a kangaroo through the forest. That never made sense. Nothing about my ancestry and growing up made sense anyway.
Was there a sense it was a sore point that you didn't want to raise, or what?
No, I didn't.
Because you're very curious. I can't imagine you not asking a whole bunch of questions about.
I didn't think of asking the questions until I was an adult. Really, It didn't even occur to me that there were questions to ask.
I suppose what I'm getting is, I think kids know when you don't ask questions.
Possibly
of your grown ups, you get the sense that it's a bit awkward or something, yeah.
And even if there was a way to know that, for me to imagine that I'd been, that the notion I was Fijian was a lie, even if it was a way for me to know that was a lie, my dad wouldn't have known otherwise if I'd asked him. Because I found out later that my dad believed what his dad told him, without question. When we found out we were Aboriginal, it was a big shock to my dad. A huge shock to my dad. And then my dad went, well, that makes sense. He was like, oh my God, big shock. Yeah. I can't really argue. That sort of thing's like when you're shocked by something that shouldn't be a shock. It was that experience for everyone in my family.
I'm guessing it must have been like all these misplaced elements in your head would suddenly be rotated, 180 degrees, and then slot into place.
Yeah, like having a big jigsaw puzzle,
right,
and then half the pieces don't fit, and you turn the whole puzzle, punk, oh, right, finished. Yeah. It was like that. It was exactly like that.
You went to university and did computer science, got an honours degree eventually in it. Why computer science?
Well, when I was 26, I was poor, and as poor people do, I went, what would be a degree that would actually make me a fair bit of money? And at the time, computer scientists were actually getting recruited out of undergrad and never actually, some of them weren't even finishing their degrees and getting like $250,000 ridiculous jobs. So it was the year 2000 I started my uni degree, and that was a big year for computer science. There were so many people getting really good jobs. Turns out I was good at computer science, but then by the time I finished my honours, it was 2006, and in 2006 there was a crash in IT jobs, and computer scientists went from having like a negative unemployment rate in that everyone had multiple jobs to computer science graduates having like a 26% or something unemployment rate.
So was this around about the time when you found the truth about your Aboriginality?
It was around that time. It was around the time of probably in my honours year, I think, when it all came out.
How did it come out?
Well, a relative approached one of my cousins and told them that we were Aboriginal. And then they told my dad, and then he contacted this relative who told him and then got the story, and then we talked. My dad and I talked about it. It made sense.
What effect did it have on you, Claire? Was it disorienting, or was it not that much of a big deal? What was it like?
I was going through a phase at the time of really starting to question whether or not the story I was Fijian even made sense. I'd been exposed to the idea of the stolen generation and the idea of what people call the hidden children, which are children hidden from the government, so the government won't ever take them. And I was beginning to question it anyway. I just didn't expect it to happen the way it did, to find out with absolute certainty.
So was it distressing or not?
No, it wasn't distressing. It was like you said, all the puzzle pieces just fell into place and everything suddenly made sense.
But at some point, something had gone horribly wrong, clearly, there. Mm. Like someone had decided, for whatever reason, to deny their Aboriginality.
It was certainly my grandfather.
It was your grandfather. Why did he want to do that?
We don't know, because he died when I was 6 weeks old. During the time my dad was born, the government were in WA were having a heightened activity of stealing children from their parents. Extremely heightened activity. They were taking children from their parents en masse. Government cars were literally driving around the suburbs and around the country towns looking for mixed-race Aboriginal kids and just taking them. They weren't even asking questions.
Well, then institutionalising them.
Institutionalising them, stolen generation stuff, the classic stuff. My dad told me that he believes that it's so that if he was taken, he would just say, no, no, I'm not Aboriginal and Fijian, without hesitation. He'd have no hesitation in saying, rather teach a kid a lie, you lie to the kid so that they can say that lie without even having to think.
Are there a lot of people in WA and elsewhere who think they are Fijian or Sri Lankan or Indian who are in fact Aboriginal?
There probably are. I know for a fact that Sally Morgan, the author, she says in My Place that she grew up thinking she was Sri Lankan all her life. And even after they discovered they were Aboriginal, her family had a hard time accepting this fact. So I think maybe it's really common. Maybe there's a whole bunch of lost and hidden children out there who their ancestry is not what they think it is.
When you found out that your grandfather had made that decision to tell your dad that he was Fijian and who told you the same thing, did you resent that? Were you angry at your grandfather for having done that initially?
I suppose my initial reaction was anger. And my dad said his initial reaction was anger. But we've spoken about it because it's like over 15 years ago now. So we've spoken about it on length multiple times, my dad and I. And I don't think either of us is angry anymore, because I think we can kind of understand what he did.
He's operating in desperate circumstances.
It's desperate circumstances. I think he'd rather lie to his own kids than have the government come and take them.
Did your grandfather have language and culture?
We don't know. Certainly, my granddad was still in contact with his own grandmother and his mother, who would have had culture. My granddad's grandmother was a culture woman. She grew up living the traditional life before white culture really got hold of her. So he would have certainly learnt language, certainly learnt culture there, and he certainly would have learnt language. And my dad has bits here and there of culture. Like, he's a great tracker, and he knows some of the bush tucker, and he knows a few cultural things. He knows a few words, like a smattering of words, but more the ones that are already a little bit known in West Australian English. My dad knew them as the only word for those things, like jilgi for freshwater crayfish, or bundi for small stone, which is, they're Aboriginal English words, but they've made it into the mainstream West Australian English as well. So I think he had some culture. My grandfather almost certainly had a culture, because my dad has a little bit.
You went to Melbourne, moved to Melbourne in the 90s and completed your computer science degree and did all that. But in the mid-2000s, you were homeless for a while, Claire.
Yes, I was.
How do you get from there to there?
I had a relationship at the time and a decent job and a nice house.
So you're living like a middle-class person for a while?
Yeah, for a while. And then I lost my job. And the day I lost my job, I came home from work and found out my partner at the time was basically leaving me already at that moment. I took off for a couple of days, like just drove off for a couple of days. When I came back, I didn't have a job anymore, so it made it really hard to pay my rent. I didn't have a partner anymore, which made it harder to pay my rent, so I couldn't pay my rent and I got evicted. It is literally as simple as that. I think most Australians, if they lost their job tomorrow, would be homeless in 2 weeks.
You had some mental health issues at the time.
I did. I suffered from pretty serious, at the time, pretty serious bipolar disorder.
Did you know that's what it was at the time, or did you think there's something horribly wrong with me?
I thought there's something horribly, terribly wrong. I wasn't sure what it was. I thought I was just really depressed. But I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder several years later, a few years later. When I had another episode and I went to a doctor and they diagnosed it. It was pretty rough time.
So you weren't so much depressive as bipolar. What were the highs like on bipolar?
I had a lot of what's called rapid cycling, where you cycle between manic and depressed in less than a week, sometimes in one day. You go from really hyperactive, excited, and then to depressed really quickly. But my highs were really energetic. I seemed really alert and really feeling great, but I wasn't the most rational person on the planet at that time. I'd feel smart though. I'd say a lot of my really good exam marks were probably while I was having a bit of a high episode. And then the downs were like so down. It was ridiculous. And I also had what's called a mixed state, which is, there's a saying they say in bipolar disorder, which is a mixed state is an emergency. That's when you've got the energy level of a manic episode, but the emotion of a depressive episode. Right. And that is a medical emergency. And I've had a few of those, and they're not good.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Claire, we were just talking before about how you became homeless after a bunch of different things intersected all at once, and you were going through a bout of mental illness at the time, bipolar disorder. While you were going through that, were people backing away from you going, oh, that Claire, she's just making poor life choices?
They do. A lot of my friendships collapsed around that time when I was really unwell. I've recontacted some of those friends since. A lot of the friendships I lost in, I haven't recontacted those people, or they've recontacted me, but it's really hard to pick up the pieces of your broken life when you've started a new life since.
There is trust as well.
I don't blame people who kind of backed away when my life was breaking, because it's not something anyone wants to be around. It's not nice. It's not uncommon for people to have their friends cut them off and they end up homeless. But in a way, it's understandable. A homeless friend is a very difficult situation to deal with, because people have an emotional obligation to give that person somewhere to stay, but that doesn't last forever. You can't keep a friend who's homeless in your house indefinitely.
So homeless and mentally ill as well.
Homeless and mentally ill. Yeah. So eventually, even if you stay with people, eventually it's going to fall apart, the ability to stay with people. So I always say that it's not difficult for someone to end up from having a normal middle-class life to living on friends' couches. And from living on friends' couches, it's really easy to end up living in your car. And from living in your car, it's really easy to end up on the street. From any situation to living on the street is a really easy trajectory. It's like a downward slide, and once you start, it's really hard to stop it. But to get back into living in a normal life is actually really difficult, because once you're down homeless on the streets, nobody will give you a chance. So you don't have those opportunities to get back out of that situation. I know I did. And people will say, well, you did it. Yeah, I did it. I was extraordinarily lucky.
Do you remember the first night you spent on the streets?
I do. I do remember the first night I spent on the streets.
Was there a feeling of like, oh, it's come to this?
Yeah, a bit, yeah. It wasn't nice. The first night I would have spent on the streets, I didn't spend on the streets as such. I'd been living in a squat for a while, and the squat got evicted. And so at the risk of, well, it's been a long time now, so I'm going to say it anyway. I did the old trick of going down the street, finding an abandoned building, leaving the lock off the door, of the padlock off the door, throw the tool out, leave the padlock off in the nearest gutter so I wouldn't be caught with it, walk away for a couple of hours, come back and go into the building and slept. As simple as that. So if you're not caught with the break and enter tools, you can't be done for break and enter. You can only get done for legal entry, which is more minor. So I did do that, and I did that for a while, and then I just end up on the streets.
Sleeping up, in a park? Or where?
In parks, bus shelters, Flinders Street Station in Melbourne.
Sleeping rough in Melbourne.
It's cold.
Were you begging or busking or something?
I was busking, quite badly. It doesn't really matter if you play badly if it's 3 in the morning on Brunswick Street. Yeah, I was busking. Because at that stage, I owned a van, but my van was broken down and had been abandoned in Wangaratta. So I had to save up enough money to not only fix my van, but get back to Wangaratta to pick it up. So that was a bit of a annoyance.
Substance abuse, any of that going on?
No. Weirdly, the only substance I've ever abused to a serious level has been alcohol. And I've always been lucky enough to manage to not become an alcoholic.
So what changed?
Well, the first thing that changed is that I met my partner. I started volunteering at Lentil as Anything, a pay-as-you-feel or pay-as-you-can-afford charity restaurant in that started in Melbourne. I think there's one in Sydney now, but I'm not sure. And I was at the big one they had in Abbotsford Convent, and I was going there to eat, and I went there and helped in the kitchen. Then from there, I eventually ended up being a full-time cook there, and then I met my partner there. She was volunteering, and I was staff.
So that was it. You had a wage again and you had a partner in life. Then you what, moved into a house?
No, I couldn't get a house. My van was fixed though. I was staying with other people a couple of times. But then we got my van and we went for a holiday trip for Christmas. We went down the Great Ocean Road, got as far as Apollo Bay, and I looked at the road to Melbourne. I turned to my partner and said, if I can find a job today, I'm not going back to Melbourne. We didn't go back to Melbourne. I found a job in a kitchen. So we stayed. We stayed in Apollo Bay, and I was there for 18 months.
What do you know now that you didn't know before you were a homeless person?
What do I know now? How easy it is to end up homeless is something I know now that I didn't know then. That homeless people are really nice, that people always help you out. You know, someone's begging and they've managed to get enough for two coffees and you've met them, they might buy you a coffee. It's that homeless people actually are nicer than you'd expect. Well, the most than people expect on average, but homes are quite nice. But the most important thing I learned is that it's really, really easy. There's a criticism sometimes of people who have pets with them when they're homeless. They go, oh, you can't afford to feed, you have got nowhere to live. Why have you got your cat or your dog or whatever with you? Well, when I end up homeless, I had a Kelpie. And without that dog, I might have gotten into more danger than I was in. Because not only did she keep me warm, that you could pull her under the blanket, it was really cold. But if I was sleeping on a park bench and she was under the park bench, anyone came too close. Well, they didn't. They backed off pretty quickly when they heard a Kelpie growling. And also people who are homeless with pets, I know this from having spoken to people, they don't end up homeless, then go get a pet. They've got a pet and end up homeless. What are they going to do with their pet? They take their dog with them.
As things were getting better for you, was there a sense that you'd escaped something or you had survive something?
There was. There was a feeling of slow improvement. After Apollo Bay, we took the caravan and went travelling. That's when we went travelling, straight after that. I didn't feel like I'd survived something. I felt like I was surviving something. I still didn't have a house. I had a caravan and a car to tow it with. I saved up, got a caravan, got a new car to tow it. But there wasn't this idea that I was out of homelessness. I'd been staying in a caravan park. I didn't have a rental reference still. So there's this feeling that I had a path out of the horrible situation I was in, but I wasn't out of it yet. It's like swimming from the bottom of a lake and you can just see the glow of the surface. That's how it felt like for a really, really long time. And I thought I was never, ever, ever going to really get out of homelessness. And I think you can take homelessness, you can take a person out of homelessness, but it takes a long time to take homelessness out of a person.
How did you learn to manage the bipolar disorder?
I changed my diet. Technically, what I did was I went on the paleo diet. When I went on the paleo diet, my symptoms reduced dramatically, like way, way down. I still have every now and then have a bit of a symptom, but it dropped right down. And also a lot of mindfulness work, mindfulness meditation, which a Buddhist psychologist helped me with at one point. Combination of those two things, going outside a lot, getting a lot of exercise, getting better sleep. You'd be surprised how important that is. All help. I can't say with any certainty I don't have bipolar disorder, but it is certainly extremely controlled at this stage of my life.
So then you'd met Lily and you got a caravan and you two decided just to go right around the country.
Yes.
Together in a caravan. What's your caravan like?
It's a old 1984 model. It's small. It's only 14 foot long. It has a C-shaped couch with a dining table in front of it, a kitchen, and a bed. And it's really old, kind of blonde wood veneer and dodgy green upholstery.
So what kind of journeys were you doing in that caravan?
Initially started just doing short ones around Victoria and into New South Wales. But then eventually we went, well, let's just go around the country. And we did. We went over to WA, went up the west coast, where we got to Kununurra. Well, we got to Kununurra and then got to Katherine. Instead of turning left to go to Darwin, we decided to go right and go down to Alice Springs. Went down to Springs, back to down to Adelaide. And then went back to Melbourne, up the east coast, across to Darwin, and then back down through the middle of Adelaide again.
So figure eight, in other words.
Figure eight. And then a bit later, we've done other trips, like when you go up through the middle, went up through the middle, across to Broome, back again to Katherine, across to Queensland, then down south to the coast, back to Melbourne again. So we've done quite a few really big trips.
What's it like living amongst that society of motorised nomads that are doing similar things in their caravans or motorhomes?
It's really quite strange. I've watched that culture evolve. It goes through phases of this really weird thing that happens more like if you're somewhere extremely remote. The more remote you are, the more likely it's going to happen. There's a thing called, Grand Amherst, called happy hour, where someone declares happy hour to be at their house, at their caravan, or under their awning, and 30, 40 people will grab deck chairs and drag them over there with their wine and sit and have a big, long talk.
Strangers, mostly.
Strangers, mostly strangers. Anyone's welcome. Like, if you're in the areas, walk over and join them. And some of them love it so much that they have a happy hour here banner that they put on the front of their awning when they want people to come over. And the other unusual thing I should have expected but didn't, is watching people crawling around under someone else's caravan or under their car or under their motorhome if it's broken down.
Or do you help each other out once again?
Yeah, right. People crawling under and fixing someone else's caravan. And I should have expected it but didn't.
This is the third time you've described that kind of society to me. There's the one of your childhood where you're doing that, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Everyone's crawling about in each other's places, helping each other out. Then there's homelessness where everyone's doing that. And here you are now in caravan park land.
Free camp land, even more so, because in the bush, most of the grey nomads don't go to caravan parks. It's just too expensive. A caravan park's around like $30 to $40 a night. If you do that for a week, that's a lot of money. There's massive free camps where there might be 100 caravans scattered around a rest area and among the trees. And yes, they are worlds that people look after each other. And maybe what I've discovered through life is that people aren't assholes. I'm a firm believer in this concept that people are generally really, really nice. And people are genuinely quite human and humane to each other. People seem to think that niceness needs to be taught. The Bible suggests that people are born sinners and have to learn to not sin. I think the opposite. I think people are born looking after each wanting to look after each other, wanting to be nice, and have to be taught to be selfish and unfriendly and not nice to each other. That's what I believe. And I've said a number of times in interviews and speeches that I don't believe in such thing as evil. I just believe that nice people do bad things for what they think at the time is a good reason.
You think about that in terms of the way Aboriginal people have been treated in this country too?
Yes, I do. I don't think the Stolen Generation, for example, was bad people doing bad things. I think it was good people doing what they thought was right at the time. Certainly you get the occasional anomalous person. I'm not going to try and say for a second that, for example, that Hitler was a nice guy. There are people who are
psychopaths.
There are psychopaths, pathologically broken people. But except for psychopaths, if all the evil in the world, you can't rely on psychopaths to have done all of it. There has to be a certain number of people who are just doing their job, or just doing what they think is the right thing to do, who don't think they're doing the wrong thing. And that stems from my attempt to write good literature. Someone told me once that there's never been a convincing villain in a novel who thought they were the bad guy. No one will believe your villain if they think they're the bad guy. And that's true because no one in our society thinks they're the bad guy, no matter who they are. So if no one thinks they're the bad guy, that means they're not the bad guy, because I think evil's like lying. You're not lying if you don't know it's a lie. And you're not evil if you don't know it's the wrong thing to do. If you think you're doing the right thing, you're not doing evil. You're just misled. And that's my firm belief in what evil is.
In between you being a cook in a kitchen for lentilless anything for people who pay what they can for their meal, in between being a computer scientist, in between doing this, in between doing that, what kind of other jobs have you had in the interim there?
I've been a cook and cooks in cafes. I've cooked at a fish and chip shop. I cleaned hotels, and that was okay. Cleaning hotels is okay.
What's the worst job you've ever had?
The worst job was cleaning a caravan park toilet. That is the worst. Not only is it the worst job I've ever had, but it's a terrible job that people don't even think about. People go to caravan parks and they don't think about the caravan park toilets. They don't think about not just the fact that some people are quite filthy, but the fact that sometimes the caravan parks, I think the amenities are basically sized for an average crowd at the caravan park,
right?
Not sized for school holidays, for example.
So did being a caravan park amenities block cleaner, did your faith in the innate goodness of humanity start to waver a little bit there, Claire?
A little bit.
A little bit.
My faith that people are not completely filthy certainly wavered.
So you've done all these different things. And it's only when you're in your 40s you decided to write mm-hmm. your first novel. What was the incident that led you to want to write that novel?
Leading up to my 41st birthday is when we left to go on our trip around Australia. Part of the plan, we planned to spend my 41st birthday on the town where my grandfather was born, because I'd never actually stopped there. I'd driven through there 25 years before, but I'd never actually stopped and looked at the place. And I called my parents up and said, I'll see you on my birthday as long as you meet me in Ravensthorpe.
Now, where is Ravensthorpe?
It's in WA on the south coast, halfway between Albany and Esperance. Almost exactly halfway to Albany and Esperance, really pretty place. We arrived there and then spent some time with Dad, went to the family graves, because a lot of my family buried in graveyards around there. And then in Ravensthorpe, we noticed this little historical society museum, which was in the abandoned dance hall. We thought, I wonder what's in there. We wandered in, paid $3 to get in, and turned around and looked, and there was an entire wall of family history for my family that none of us had seen. My dad hadn't seen it, my mum hadn't seen it, I hadn't seen it. There's a street named after my family in Ravensthorpe. So there's these two Irish settler boys who married Aboriginal women, and I'm descended from one of them. But after the massacre in that town, my family all left.
What was the massacre in the town?
There was a massacre in a place called Kokonerup. Kokonerup's like 10 kilometres out of town. There was an incident involving, stories go, a rape of a girl, an Aboriginal girl, and her uncle speared the rapist, and then his family shot all the Aboriginal people.
When you say all the Aboriginal people?
60.
60 people.
60 people.
Members of your family?
They were members of my family. And
how long ago was that, Claire?
That was in 1880-ish, around the 1880s sometime.
And there was a memorial there to that?
Yeah, there was. So when I was in the museum, I told them who I was, what my surname was, and by this stage we'd run out and got my dad and made him come in because he didn't want to go into the museum. So, oh, museum, that's boring. And then he got fascinated by all the stories. We told them who we were, and they said, we're opening a memorial to the massacre in 2 weeks' time. Come back for that. Then 2 weeks later I came back for the memorial, and just hearing the stories, the way they were told, it shook me. And the story for Terra Nullius, in its final form, appeared in my head just there. It was just there, like sitting there, like I'd been waiting at the back of my head and was waiting to come forward. It came forward, and I started writing it that night after going to the memorial opening. And the memorial had been built on land donated by the landowner of the property where the massacre happened. So someone bought the land a few generations later, bought it from the family who had been involved in the massacre, the settler family, and then decided to donate some acres of his land for a memorial to the massacre.
And with that, the whole story just walked through a door and said, here I am, and write me down.
Yeah, it said, here I am, write me down. So I wrote it. I wrote it in the caravan as we're travelling up the West Coast. I got to Broome and I spoke to Mugabala Books, which are an Aboriginal publisher in Broome. I spoke to the staff there and they said that I should enter the Black and White Indigenous Writing Fellowship. So I finished my manuscript as we went down through the middle, down to Adelaide, got back to Melbourne, edited my manuscript, posted it, and then left again. Went up the East Coast. And on the East Coast, I found out I'd won that fellowship. It's almost like that novel, Terra Nullius, wanted to happen. And it found a way to do it through me. That's how it feels sometimes.
So part of this process for you about recovering your Aboriginal heritage means recovering knowledge mm-hmm. and stories. So has that been given to you?
The members of my family are possibly one of the most documented and exposed Noongar families there are. There's been lots written about us. And by us. So both by scouring through the family, the archives, every time I find anything that's pertaining from any archive ever, I'll pay whatever I have to pay to get the archivist to make me a copy, which sometimes is expensive, but I've spent lots of money on that. And I've spoken to members of my extended family. It's been a long process because when the massacres and stolen generation, all that stuff happened, it basically destroyed a lot of our cultural material. So finding anything is extremely difficult. But it's been a long process and one that'll be going for the rest of my life, trying to get back culture.
Claire Coleman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.